Welcome to the Resilient Nurse Podcast, where we discuss the tools and practices nurses, faculty, students, and new nurses are using to renew and amplify their resilience. This podcast is a special series within the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing's On the Pulse podcast. In each episode, we cover the complexities, misconceptions, and new pathways toward keeping our nursing workforce resilient throughout Maryland and beyond. Our podcast comes out of the R3 initiative, which stands for Renewal, Retention, and Resilience in Maryland Nurses. Today, the healthcare system finds itself in a place familiar to many outside healthcare, a growing gap in relationships and understanding between C-suite executives and frontline staff. We all know what it sounds like, right? They won't do this. They should expect that. Why don't they understand our pressures? And at the same time, this dynamic, this relationship, has alignment around a common and growing problem. And that is that healthcare executives and clinicians of all sorts are leaving healthcare due ultimately to burnout. So let's look at the statistics. Through the first 9 months of 2023, 125 CEO changes took place at hospitals, which is an increase of 67% from last year. This, according to a report by Challenger Gray and Christmas, and many longtime CEOs are stepping aside in the midst of a grueling climate. On the frontline side, the American Nurses Foundation and McKinsey surveyed over 7,000 nurses in the spring of 2023 to better understand mental health and well-being in the nursing workforce. The survey results revealed that symptoms of burnout and mental health challenges among nurses remain high. In this podcast, we'll explore how addressing retention and resilience in this us-them culture could be transformed into a we culture, where listening to understand each other, collaboration, and win-win solutions for all are realized. I'm your host, Nancy Reller, and my two guests have thought about and worked in this space for years, and I'm excited to learn from them. Liz Boehm is the executive strategist for the CEO Coalition, part of Stryker. In this role, Liz works with healthcare leaders across the industry to identify and share innovative ways to protect the safety and well-being of our healthcare workforce. For more than 20 years, Liz has been writing and researching and speaking about human-centered strategies to improve the overall healthcare experience. My second guest is well known to us, Cinda Rushton, who is the Chief Synergy Strategist for the R3 Initiative. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you so much, Nancy. And I'm so excited to be here with both of you, particularly Cinda and I have had some really excellent collaborations. And I do want to stress, I am so grateful for Stryker's support in this work, and the views I'm going to share today are my own.
Great. Thank you, Liz. So great to have you with us. So, Liz, you have such an interesting perspective of the C-suite. Describe what burnout looks like to the executive who is really looking on the business side of the system. Everyone is, of course, focused on providing wonderful care for patients, and we wouldn't for a minute question the intent of all involved here. But what does burnout look like for executives?
Burnout looks a lot like what it looks like for frontline folks, except that it manifests differently because they have different responsibilities, right? So burnout still is fundamentally a mix of emotional exhaustion, cynicism, depersonalization, and reduced personal efficacy. Now, when it happens in a leader, for a frontline person, it looks like, challenges connecting with their patients and potentially reduced outcomes. What it looks like for a leader is the similar challenges connecting with their team members and difficulty making some of the decisions or balancing all of the multiple things that they have to consider in their decision making. And it's come from a lot of the same places as it does for frontline folks as well. During the pandemic, executives experienced a ton of fear and uncertainty for themselves and the people they lead, who they felt a huge amount of responsibility for. There was so much chaos, so much rapid change. They were tracking down supplies, trying to find PPE, changing buildings and processes, redeploying staff. There was the racial reckoning following George Floyd's murder. There was a lot they were trying to digest. And now they're in an era of workforce shortages, regulatory changes, mounting financial pressures. They're really experiencing a lot of cognitive overload, which is also a challenge that frontline folks have a lot when, tools and resources and processes on the front lines are not designed appropriately for their cognitive capacity. And even things like the culture changes and rising workplace violence that have the public, who used to be lauding healthcare folks as heroes, now railing against them as, creators of chaos, that hits executives, where they live as well. And just leadership in general can be very isolating. There's a pressure to be confident, to have all the answers, to take command. It's hard for leaders to tap into the vulnerability that ultimately makes them great leaders, especially when many are feeling underappreciated, dehumanized, even blamed for having to make challenging decisions, some of which are dictated from outside forces such as regulators or payers or those sorts of things. And then just like frontline folks, they can feel shame around feeling burned out, especially if they're not on the front lines and they really are wanting to lift up frontline folks and seeing them making the life and death decisions. The leaders feel like they perhaps don't have the right to have those same difficult feelings.
Thank you so much. That shame and blame is such a powerful depleter, honestly, of our psyche and our ability to continue. Cinda, in this same study that was done by the American Nursing Foundation and McKinsey, found that the intent to leave was roughly 41% among nurses who provide direct care to patients. So when you think about what Liz has said and nurses at the front lines and in clinical settings, what do you notice are the similarities and the differences between how nurses are experiencing burnout?
So I think Liz has done a great job of sort of outlining the architecture that both of them are embedded in. One of the things I think is a difference is executives are charged with making the decisions, and nurses are often the people who have to implement them. And a lot of times there is a disconnect in terms of the decision-making process about how do we actually involve the people who will implement these decisions in the design itself. And I think that's where a lot of nurses are feeling that their trust has been broken, because they're like, we've been the ones who have been making this system work in all of its complexities and ineffectiveness and on and on. And they often will say, we weren't asked. We weren't asked our opinion. Or if we were asked our opinion, it wasn't taken into account, or it didn't appear to be taken into account, because there's often, the need to make rapid decisions. But there's also now, I think, an opportunity for us to step back and say, well, how do we recalibrate that? I think everybody is experiencing overload and overwork because of the shortages, because of the continuing increase in patients who need healthcare, and trying to allocate the scarce resources that we have, including people. And so I think some of it is this frustration of not feeling heard, not feeling that their contribution is actually acknowledged and appreciated, and actually leveraged towards solutions. So it contributes to this narrative of nobody's listening, nobody cares, nobody is actually acknowledging the sacrifices that we have had to make to make the system work.
So, I'd love to respond to that for a second, Nancy, just because I think it's such a critical point, because if I look at a leader who's experiencing burnout, their capacity to reach out and truly listen and put in, you know, to take the time to listen, to have those conversations, to do the observations, to do it, is going to be diminished. So it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Where a burned out executive fails to go to the front line out of expediency or their perception of expediency. And then that creates more of this othering, which then makes them feel more like, well, nobody appreciates the effort I am putting in. And I do want to stress that, you know, if you look at the organizational hierarchy and power here, the onus, in my opinion, is on the leaders more so than on the front lines, right? They're the ones, and I'm not suggesting that we don't have compassion and empathy for the burnout they're experiencing and the overload, but when you are in a position of power, I think the onus is on you to step back, to find ways to address this and to reestablish and build that trust coming from that top, as opposed to suggesting that it's a frontline responsibility. I don't know if you'd agree with that, Simba.
Well, I think it's really, really important. I mean, obviously it's a bi-directional process, but I think your point about if you have the power in the relationship, it's in a way similar to clinicians' relationships with their patients. We have to take the responsibility of setting the tone for that relationship, for our communication, for creating the conditions for understanding. And I think that is a really key point for leaders to think about how the process and the communication decision-making actually may be contributing to this, the feelings that we've heard so much of betrayal. You know, it feels like a betrayal when I don't feel that I have been listened to, or that I have been taken advantage of in ways that feel disrespectful to me. So it seems to me that that mismatch just adds more, almost gas on the fire, when we're already in this very depleted environment. And truthfully, both sides of the equation, their capacity for trust is already contracted when they come together. So neither side has a lot of resources to be able to engage with each other.
I'm wondering about the common issue around, I don't have time. I don't have time to ask for input from the front line or the middle managers. And I can share my experience, but I'd love to hear from both of you about that. The issue of time becomes such a in a way, a crutch for healthcare to heal itself, when it may not take as much time as the sort of anticipatory anxiety around taking the time to get the input and provide the feedback so that there's less rework. Do you have thoughts about that, Liz?
Yeah, I'll start with this. And it's easy to point out what this looks like and really hard to implement. So I want to, again, not sound like I'm indicting leaders for this. When you are burned out, when your resources are depleted, you start to think more in the short term. And in the short term, it is easier to make a unilateral decision. In the long term, you generally end up cleaning that mess up for much longer than it might have taken at the beginning. But it's the same as with any change. This is why change management is so challenging, is if we start at point A and point A is hard, and we're trying to get to point B and point B is easier, we have to go through point C, which is even harder. Right. So this idea of putting the upfront effort in at a time when it feels like there's so many demands coming at you. There's so little time. The consequences are dire. We, you know, that pandemic mindset, even of things are going to change tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow. It's going to be a whole new world. I have to solve this today. It's hard to get out of. So I think that time, you know, it's a question of trading off time in the short run for time in the long run. And that's hard to do when time feels so tight in the short run. But it's what I think the smartest executives are doing around trying to rebuild that trust, around making sure that they don't go back to the old normal, but they co-create a new normal in partnership with the frontline folks that they're serving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nancy, I think this question of time is an age-old challenge for all of us. You know, often our narrative about time is a scarcity mindset. It is, there's not enough, there's not enough, there's not enough. And truly, it's a question of how do we want to allocate that time? You know, we think about this in the context of our interactions with patients a lot. And like Liz says, often the moments that we invest to listen and understand actually prevent misunderstanding in the future. And it may eventually even save time if we invest in the initial understanding and listening. And I think part of the time crunch is also that there's a kind of narrative that involving others takes too much time and too much effort. And there's some truth to that. But I think, as Liz points out, it may be too short-sighted. It may be part of our crisis management. And arguably, healthcare is constantly in a crisis management mode.
Yeah, I wonder, I want to talk about another piece of this, which is kind of an ongoing debate around ways to resolve burnout that looks like it's up to the individual nurse to fortify their resilience, or it's a systemic problem that leadership must fix. And that inherently puts the problem and the resolutions at odds with each other, this either or dynamic. So I'd love to hear from both of you. How do we make this a yes and solution?
So I'll start with this one. That tension is real. You'll hear people railing against individual well-being and saying system change is the only way to go. And you'll hear other folks saying there are things that are in your control. Don't take that victim stance. So I'm gonna hit a little bit on well-being and then system change and then make the argument for both. So when you're focused on individual well-being, the frontline often experience that is victim blaming, right? Even before the pandemic, we had conditions that were conducive to burnout in healthcare. We take these incredibly resilient, incredibly dedicated, incredibly passionate people, bring them into environments that are not optimized for their capacities, their well-being, their joy, their even necessarily best practices, and then say, you need to make yourself more resilient, is what it feels like to them. That said, there's actually very real science behind the benefits of things like breath work, gratitude, mindfulness. And I'm releasing a podcast episode in the coming weeks with Steve Forty, who's the chief well-being officer at Hospital for Special Surgery, who even calls it a moral imperative for healthcare team members and nurses, given the critical nature of the work that they do, to care for themselves. And I think executives have a tendency to go towards that well-being programming because in many ways it's less complex. It's easier to put forward a single training or create a respite room than it is to overhaul the EHR, change the structures of teams, shift culture, which are the things that are more in the system change front. And that's that same paradox I was talking about before with that time challenge. Is the effort to get to that better way is often higher than the effort of the status quo, even though somewhere down the road, you're going to end up at a lower effort place. And so that feels overwhelming to navigate when leaders and the teams that they need to have execute the change are burned out. But I think Cinda and I both agree that this is a both and equation. And anyone that's pitting it as an either or is I think doing a disservice to what needs to happen, but also not recognizing the ways in which they interconnect with one another, right? It takes resilient, well, whole nurses to drive the kinds of system change that we need. And they need to have systems that are not constantly depleting that resilience, wellness, wholeness, in order to continue being the leaders and change agents that we need them to be.
So, Cinda, R3 and other programs that you've put in place have certainly addressed this, not just from the individual nurse or faculty member or student, nursing student level, but also a systemic level to help, you know, parts of the nursing workforce to learn how to create the culture that welcomes back a resilient nurse into a culture that's whole and healthy. So share with us a bit about your insights, having done this for quite some time.
Well, Liz and I completely agree on this, you know, reframing of not either or, but and. And, you know, it really is polarity management to a large degree. And one of the reasons that I really appreciate that framework is that it helps you realize what the trade-offs are if you overemphasize one or the other. And then from that, you can begin to say, oh, well, maybe there's a better balance here. And so I think mechanisms like that, frameworks that help us really understand and see what those trade-offs are, can be really helpful to us. And as you said, Nancy, you know, we are the people in the system. And our investment in ourselves is not only because we are in the system, but because we are human beings. We are deserving of that basic self-stewardship for every one of us. And, you know, I've often thought this narrative about the system, I'm not sure the system is going to save us. I think we have to actually take steps ourselves to make it possible for ourselves to be whole and to be able to restore our sense of agency to choose what is right for us. And without that, it's easy to fall into a pattern of feeling victimized and feeling as if we are incapable of meeting these challenges, when in fact, our work has demonstrated again and again, we are a resilient group. It is not a deficit model. It is a strengths model. And the idea that we want to amplify what's already there and to use that as a foundation for system change is really what we're aiming toward, so that we can engage systems in a more intentional way, using our values, using our awareness of the patterns in the organization that are actually undermining our integrity and well-being, and then designing solutions based on that to actually begin to make more incremental change. And, you know, the reality is it can feel pretty overwhelming when you think about changing this whole healthcare system. You can immediately feel like, well, there's nothing I can do about that. But part of our work has been to also empower people in the system to not feel responsible for changing the whole system. But in the end, we are all responsible for how we show up. We are responsible for how we practice in whatever role that we have. And so to kind of bring it back down to what contribution can I make in this system, no matter what anybody else does, that will contribute to my sense of purpose, my sense of well-being and integrity in the midst of whatever's happening around me.
Another issue that I've been thinking about relative to this is this stigma that still exists around mental health. And physicians, I've talked to a couple of physicians about this, And perhaps nurses are feeling this way as well, and certainly healthcare executives. Mental health is still stigmatized. So how do you both see this problem and perhaps some solutions to destigmatizing it so people are empowered to get the help that they so deserve?
So I look at this from two perspectives. I look at it from a cultural perspective and a structural perspective. From a cultural perspective, I do think that one of the silver linings that came from the pandemic is greater discussions, acknowledgement, and recognition, both of mental health needs and for normalizing help-seeking behavior. Now it hasn't gone far enough. It's not universal, right? So you look at different genders, different ethnicities, different races, different languages, and they both have, there's different levels of stigma and potentially different abilities to access those resources. But I think we're moving culturally in the right direction on those things. And I think, you know, what I'd love to see is more and more prominent folks whose positions feel very secure, putting their hand up and saying, I have sought mental health care. Because it's part of what makes me a stronger, healthier human and a stronger, healthier leader or a stronger, healthier clinician. From a structural perspective, I'm a huge fan of the work that the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation is leading to remove stigmatizing questions from credentialing and licensure applications. And to my mind, you know, they've done great. I think Virginia has moved really far in that. They're taking sort of they started with physicians. They're opening up to all licensed clinicians, but it isn't safe anywhere until it's safe everywhere, right? I can't afford as a clinician to seek mental health if I might move to a state where that's going to put my license in jeopardy, right? Sometime in my unforeseeable future, who, you know, people practice 30. We want them practicing 30, 40, 50 years. So those structural barriers need to be removed and removed absolutely everywhere so that we actually are encouraging structurally clinicians to seek the help that they need.
Liz, that suggestion about the licensure, I think, is a really important step. And it's also important, I think, for healthcare organizations to take a look at their own processes within their organizations around credentialing, around how people can access mental health services. So for example, we have been doing a pilot using a proactive wellness check-in for nurses on clinical units to normalize, you know, having an assessment is not requiring them to make an appointment and take all the effort to try to get something scheduled. It's part of everyday practice. So it begins to normalize that, you know, everybody needs support. No one is immune to that need. And so if we take away some of the barriers to, you know, when you are depleted or depressed or anxious, the idea of trying to navigate a scheduling system that is so complex, that's probably going to be a barrier. So trying to think differently about, number one, how do we help normalize asking for help? And the second thing is, along with that, in organizations, there's often the narrative that this is not confidential and that my requesting support or resources will in some way be used in a way that is not beneficial to me. And so the trust in the privacy and the confidentiality that goes along with those requests is another thing organizations really can strengthen and make good on the promise that this is private, confidential consultation. And the other part of that is, and we have certainly explored this in our R3 program, nurses in particular, as well as other clinicians, are not very good at receiving support when it's offered. If you think about how many resources were created during COVID, what we hear all over the place is nobody's using them. Well, maybe we need to examine a little bit more about what are the barriers internally and within our profession that get in the way of saying, hey, I need to raise my hand and say, I need some help here. And that's not viewed as weakness or failure or somehow deficiency. So I think we've got some work, you know, in our own house to be able to take advantage of what is actually out there.
And one thing I would add to that, Cinda, is I know some organizations' benefit structures require folks to get care within their own system. And I'm not sure that's the greatest idea for physical health. It's definitely not the greatest idea for mental health, where you do want to know that confidentiality is in place, that you're not going to run into your therapist or psychopharmacologist in the hallway at a moment you're feeling vulnerable and not prepared, right? So that thinking of how the structure of what we support people's access to, you know, and maybe someday there will be so little stigma we won't need to worry about that, but I still think that right to have confidential care is something we need to look at structurally.
I love this discussion about solutions, and I'd love to hear a little bit more from each of you about what are the innovations that are taking hold in systems and at the bedside that you can share with us so that people listening could maybe, you know, take an idea that's, you know, growing and run with it. So Liz, from your perspective, leadership perspective, what do you know to be happening?
Yeah, so I'm going to not speak to narrow focus solutions, because I think there are so many of those and very many of them are effective, and speak more to the leadership behaviors and attitudes. So one of them, and this is one I know Cinda will agree with because she's actually been a great mentor for me around this, is living into your values in every single decision. And my favorite example of this is a physician leader who has since left a large multi-state health system, who looked at every single thing, whether it was an email about required trainings or a process change or a structure in the EHR, and filtered it through two critical questions. Does it support our mission, and is it kind? Mm-hmm. So the mission often had that external facing, right? Are we actually doing what we say we're going to do in terms of providing amazing care and supporting well-being of our patients and families? And are we doing that in a way that supports our culture of trust and connection through that kindness lens? And that also, you know, has an equity bent to it as well, to think about not just is it kind to me, is it kind for everyone? Is there a group that is disenfranchised by this kind of decision? So having that kind of ethical framework to live into your values, I think, is absolutely critical. Another one I love is building trust and connections. And here, you know, I want to be a little careful, because the most common approach that leaders take to this is leader rounding. And I've seen some recent research from Brian Sexton at Duke that suggests leader rounding, particularly when it's asking about what's going right, has very positive impacts on staff. But I want to call out a different example, which is Emily Chase, the CNO at University of Chicago Medicine, where during the pandemic, she kept hearing from her frontline folks, you just don't understand. You just aren't seeing what we're living on the front lines. And she said, you know, you're right. And so she created a program in which every one of her team, every other week, would do a 12-hour shift. Every other Monday, they're doing a 12-hour shift. If they have clinical credentials, they're working side by side clinically. If they don't have clinical credentials, then they are working side by side administratively. And a 12-hour shift of shared work creates a fundamentally different level of connection, a different level of visibility, a different level of we're in it together, a different ability to devise solutions together than a 15 or 20 minute leader round. And so, you know, I think most people would look at that and say, there's no way I could do 12 hours every other week, but they made it work. And just like our discussion earlier of, is it harder and does it take more time to get the input up front? I would bet that she has a much easier time pushing through, and pushing through is probably the wrong word, but creating, implementing, and sustaining change programs because she has that trust and that insight. And then the third idea, and this, you know, a lot of hospitals use the concept of crucial conversations for having conversations with patients. But that idea of creating recognizing our shared destination, which is a little bit of living into your values, recognizing what is fact versus what is story, and really coming together towards those shared solutions. And for the front lines, that often means letting go of cherished solutions, right? So increases in staff might not always be the solution. And for leaders, it means really listening to what the struggles are and why people are asking for more staff or more resources, and then arriving together at shared solutions, the same way, you know, we say in crucial conversations to do with team members, is absolutely essential.
Hmm. Terrific. Thank you, Liz. Those are great specific examples. Thank you. Cinda, what about you?
Well, you know, I think Liz has touched on some really great points. You know, one of them related to communication that I think is one particularly for leaders is noticing when we shift into transactional communication, because what we saw in the pandemic, and I have had many nurses say, you know, it wasn't that I expected my leader to know all the answers, but I at least wanted them to acknowledge how hard this was, which is about connecting at an empathic level. So instead of just, you know, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, boom, 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 what people really wanted was that acknowledgement, that human connection. And so simple things like that, I think, can go a long way in terms of just the relational connection, but also the shared understanding. Another example is, you know, the part of the magnet criteria has to do with structural empowerment and mechanisms for nurses to have a voice. And I know many institutions are really looking carefully at that, of how during the pandemic, some of them were let go out of the idea that we don't have time. What I've learned from some CNO colleagues of mine is that when they invested in those forums where there was an opportunity to engage frontline nurses in the problem and the solution, that it builds trust and it builds relationships that are necessary to implement sometimes really hard decisions. So the having those structures that are more than window dressing, but are actually authentic places for the exchange and co-creation of solutions, is really, really important right now. And I know one of our upcoming podcasts is going to be about how the narrative around our work is needs to be intentional and to be shifted. So mechanisms like platforms that allow nurses to have access to their leaders without necessarily doing a town hall, finding ways to engage and to make sure that leaders are actually getting a broad representation of the voices in the community, not just the one who is the most angry or the most outraged, but actually to harness the wisdom that's out there in a different way, using, you know, perhaps technology, AI to help us to increase those connections, I think are really, really important. And then the other one, of course, that Liz sort of pointed to is having truly living our values through an ethical framework for human resource allocation, where we're much more intentional about noticing and designing based on those core values of respect and balancing benefits and burdens, and doing so in a fair, just, equitable way. that begins to shift our decision-making process. So I think the more that we can use those kinds of frameworks, the more that we will be able to have confidence in each other that we are committed to the same things.
So interesting, because what occurs to me is the need for all of us to slow down so that we can hurry up. Slow down so that we can listen well. Do rounds that are genuine and authentic, and you're really hearing what is being said. Live in someone else's shoes. Take their perspective. Understand their perspective. And forget about the pizza parties, because that's not the kind of authentic, you know, meaningful recognition that matters these days. What I'd love to get from you finally, what are the three pieces of wisdom, advice, or perhaps a request you might ask of the healthcare workforce? And be specific so that people can take it and run with it.
So I'll start with one of my favorites, which is, you know, you have to have compassion for yourself. That's whether you're a leader or a frontline person, you can take advantage of known tools. Figure out the ones that work for you. If breath work is not your thing, look at exercise. Look at the way you're sleeping. You absolutely matter. You are your best first investment. And if you're experiencing burnout, seeking help externally and adopting practices that are in your control are going to be hugely helpful. Small changes are the only way to move that forward. I'd always want to bring up values and ethical frameworks, but I'm going to let Cinda hit that because she's the real expert there. And then the second thing I would say then is communicate and listen authentically, because, you know, you said a minute ago, you know, it's not the pizza parties. It's the real face-to-face dialogue. Us and them breaks down when you're face-to-face. It's so much harder to other a person who's standing in front of you, listening to you, sharing, even if they're frustrated, even if there's challenges in the conversation. If you can bring respect and real listening to those face-to-faces, you're going to break down that us and them. And then the third is these system challenges require collaboration. And for leaders, at least, that means all levels. So with your teams and those you serve, look to bring diverse perspectives together, whether that is, you know, across nursing, physicians, techs, environmental services and others, or different, you know, race, ethnicity, language, gender, et cetera, to make sure that you've got those perspectives. But it's also collaborating with your peers, right? If you look at issues like workplace violence, those are universal. And we should be sharing solutions, because every healthcare worker in every system deserves to come into work and be safe. And that may also require collaboration with ecosystem partners, whether that's tech vendors, associations, payers, what have you, because those system barriers usually are not just your system, they're ecosystem system challenges. And so building those connections and relationships in that same, so it's not us, them with payers, it's not us, them with tech vendors, is part of what leadership can do to streamline some of those system changes.
Thank you so much, Liz. Cinda, your three things.
Well, the first thing is be who you really are and know it's enough. I think we have so much expectation of ourselves sometimes to fix unsolvable problems that we overlook the opportunities that are right in front of us. So the second thing would be really consider what part of this issue is mine to carry. And what I mean by that is, if you're a leader, what is the scope of your responsibility? And if you're a frontline person, the same question, what part of this do I have influence over and am I responsible for? Now, those calculations may be slightly different, but I think when we can be more clear about what our contribution is and what we are actually responsible for, I think it can relieve some of this feeling of the weight of having to fix problems that honestly no one person can solve on their own, that we really do need each other. And the third thing is to remember why we're here. We have a shared goal, and that goal is to create the conditions for health, for healing, for well-being for everyone. And if we can, in the midst of all the chaos, in the midst of all of the confusion and uncertainty, if we can continue to go back to the why, it will ground us in creating pathways for collaboration, for new and innovative ideas. It means we have to let go of some of the things that we have held tight to in our identities and in our practices. But at the same time, when we can open our hands just a little bit, not hold quite so tight, there's new ideas that can emerge. And if we can give each other the benefit of the doubt in those moments, that we actually come at these questions from different perspectives and different roles and different levels of responsibility, but that our core work is the same, it may help us to engage with each other with a little more grace and a little more compassion toward each other, and make it easier for all of us to contribute in the way that we are trained to and that we are really intending to, which is why there's so much distress, I think, is when we cannot fulfill our expectations of our role, our social contract, we feel as if we failed. And so we're going to have to work on how we create realistic and feasible expectations of ourselves and of others.
Thank you so much to both of you. I really hope that there are listeners who are not in healthcare, because this conversation could apply to almost any industry, because the principles and the wisdom that you've shared is universal. So thank you, Liz. Thank you, Cinda, for a terrific conversation.
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Cinda.
Thank you, Liz, as always, and Nancy, of course.
The R3 website hosts over 30 resilience tools and practices for faculty, students, and new nurses throughout Maryland. Also found on the website are beautifully designed and easy to use free social media graphics available for personal or professional distribution. The R3 website address is nursing.jhu.edu/R3. We hope you'll join us next time for the Resilient Nurse Podcast. Funding for R3 comes from the Nurse Support Program 2 grant, administered by the Maryland Higher Education Commission, and is funded through the Health Services Cost Review Commission.